If we can get everybody back in their seats, and while folks are taking their seats, I just wanted to take a quick moment and introduce the Assistant Administrator for NOAA Fisheries, Eric Schwab. Eric, thank you for coming. He's here to listen to what goes on at this workshop, and Eric will be around if people have some individual questions for him. But thank you for your interest, Eric.
Next on the agenda, we have Mark Grant, who's with the Northeast Regional Office of the National Marine Fisheries Service. He's going to go over the sector annual reports.
Good morning. I've worked with a lot of you. I know most of you, but for those who don't, my name is Mark Grant. I'm one of the sector policy analysts at the Fisheries Service, which basically means that full-time I work on sector implementation, which is a lot of hands-on work with the various sector managers, some of the individual members of the sectors, and problem solving. So generally that means I've heard all the good and bad that's happened so far. And I suppose that'll color a little bit as I present what I got in the year-end reports for everybody. Okay, so in the regulations, each sector is required to submit an annual report within 60 days of the end of the fishing year. We had 17 sectors that were approved to operate in 2010, and all of them did submit their report. The reports did vary quite dramatically in quality. We did follow up with all the sectors to request additional detailed information, particularly with regards to ACE trades and reallocation information. On the timing of things, we didn't quite make the 60-day deadline. You know, in the end, in order for us to get all of the data together and finalized to the sectors, it wasn't possible to do that within 60 days of the end of the year. So what we actually did was split the year-end report into two different parts for the first year. And the idea was that part one would come out with the information that was available at that time, and then it would be followed up with additional information as it became available. Didn't go that smoothly, but then nothing large ever does. A few things I do want to point out. The sectors had a general concern about the confidentiality of the information they'd be submitting in the reports. The way it's written is that they must submit a copy to NIMS and a copy to the council, by which we interpret that to mean the council staff, who have a confidentiality agreement with the service, can have the detailed reports in their entirety. But there is information in the reports that would be considered confidential business information, which is why the entire reports are not released to the public. Okay. So just a little bit about the organization of the reports. It was divided into sort of seven discrete sections. The sector catch, sector general information, the catch information, and the ACE information, this was all tabular information, just simple tables that portrayed the information. And then there was some qualitative text to go with it to explain it. Things like fishing effort, the discard estimation method, the violation reports, and the vaguely named other relevant information section, this is basically qualitative text. All right, so a bit about the general sector information. What I've done here is sort of pooled information together for all the sectors as a single cohort. So there were 761 permits. 441 of them landed some kind of fish during the year. And the little asterisk is just to note that my numbers are about three different from the ones, like, you know, numerically the count is three off from what was in the SSB's report, but I'm not too worried about the precision there. In total, only 310 of those permits actually landed some kind of regulated groundfish, and then 183 of them landed other groundfish, which would be small mesh or pout, and about 427 landed other species that wouldn't be managed under the groundfish plan, and that would be everything from squid to skate to something else. And then just, you know, quick summary of the number of trips by the sector vessels and, well, how many of them were directed at groundfish and how many were directed at non-groundfish. So you can see one of the things there right off the bat is there's a lot more trips that aren't actually going for groundfish versus ones that target groundfish. But, you know, that's not entirely new. So we did present a lot of the basic information directly to the sectors as a way of reducing their burden in developing the year-end report. Because, frankly, there's a lot going on at the end of the year, and summing it up in a report to provide out isn't always the top priority. So to the extent we could, when it came down to information that NIMS had in our own databases, what we did was generate tables and provide them directly to the sector managers so they could put them into their reports. So in terms of sector information, what we did was give them a list of all the permits, allocation to every vessel, and that's a key thing. Each sector basically specified that they had split up the sector's allocation to the individual members based on the PSCs of the members' permits. So basically what a member brought into the sector allocated back to him. And so we basically just used that information to populate that table. And then we also provided them with tables about the landing ports that were used, which vessels landed regulated species or small mesh species or other species, and basically the detailed version of the information that's in this table. And just a sort of a quick math on some of the numbers. So it was about 65% of sector permits that landed some kind of fish, any kind, during the year. 41% actually landed regulated species, which would be all your familiar ground fish. 24% landed small mesh species or pout, and 56% landed non-ground fish species. So you can definitely see how those numbers translate into the fishery as a whole. Okay, next slide, please. A little bit about landing ports. This is just a quick count by state of the number of ports that had sector landings reported and the number of sectors that were landing there. One thing of note, we go by dealer reported information. So if, for instance, a dealer in a state purchased fish by truck, it might list a state that a boat didn't land in because the dealer was based there, even though the vessel landed somewhere else. Next slide, please. Well, unless people wanted to take a minute to look at it, but you can basically see a lot more ports were used than, or a lot more states had landings than we initially anticipated. And I suppose one thing to point out about that, and would be in particular with some of the mid-Atlantic ports like Virginia and Maryland, initially sectors really only thought about the ports where they would land ground fish. And then as we approached the start of the fishing year, people realized that, you know, if you're fishing for monkfish and you've got a ground fish permit, that's a ground fish trip too. So we did have to scurry a little bit and add some ports into their operations plans where they had a seasonal fishery down in the mid-Atlantic. Okay, so fishing effort. The idea here was that we were asking the sectors to give us a text description about fishing effort by the sector vessels for the year. We were looking for how the effort was distributed among the vessels, how members' businesses or business practices changed, how this compared to fishing under the day at sea system. And a little bit we had hoped to get follow-up on consolidation. In each sector operations plans, one of the requirements was that they gave us a forecast of what they expected for consolidation, and so we had hoped that we'd get some follow-up information on what actually happened there. The level of detail in the reports varied greatly. There were some that were excellent, there were some that were pretty sparse, and there was a good range in between. Something I want to point out, and this gets back to some of the concerns about confidentiality and also to one of the panels that will come up later about expectations for sector managers. One manager, well, actually possibly more than one, used the same quote, but he said, "It is unknown what differences occurred in fishing effort, fishing method, or cost to the membership, as it is not the sector manager's job to collect or track this type of information." And so I'm going to leave that general discussion to the panel, but I just want to raise it here as we start talking about the information that's in the reports. There were definitely some concerns, and they differed between the sectors about what they should be providing from a confidentiality standpoint, or what they should be providing from, is it their job to keep that information and provide it to the council, or NIMS in this case as well. Major themes, obviously, the ACEs were divided out to the members based on their PSCs. I do want to note that a lot of the sectors actually withheld a portion of that as a buffer from their members, so that was there as a safety in terms of making sure they didn't run over their ACEs. And in general, sectors basically had very independent operation of their members. One of the things we had wondered was, you know, to what extent we'd see things where they came up with collective plans about, okay, we have this much allocation, it won't support all of us, so the following five boats are going to focus offshore, these are going to divide it up inshore, or any other thing like that. That basically didn't happen. All of them noted that fishing and business practices changed under sectors, and a real key point to this was there were a few sectors who specified that they had really hoped not to change their practices at all, and they just weren't able to accomplish that. Once they got into the sector system, that even if they had wanted to keep things the way they had been, they couldn't manage that. They had to change to match the system. And we didn't get a whole lot of information about redirection of effort, which was one of the other parts that we'd received in the operations plans, where we said, what kind of consolidation do you think might happen? Do you think there'll be a redirection of effort? And we didn't really hear a whole lot of detail in the year-end reports about how true the forecasts had been. A little more on fishing effort. Most sectors noted consolidation. There were only a couple that said they had no new consolidation. Consolidation, of course, is a really tricky thing to quantify because... Oh, wait, are we... One more. Okay, there we are. Thanks. You know, if someone already had several permits that they owned and some were on skiffs, a couple were on active hulls, you know, maybe they put all that ace onto the two existing active hulls or one if it was that case. So there was some of that, but that had been happening before under the Day at Sea leasing system, but maybe it didn't always look the same. So it is a really hard thing to quantify, but overall, qualitatively, the sector said there was more consolidation in almost all cases. A few of the larger sectors really highlighted that they had improved the efficiency of their operations, which could be taken as a plus. A few of the smaller sectors particularly highlighted that transitioning costs really impacted fishing effort, and really instead of impacted, I should say reduced. One of the things they were noting was that the costs of this reduced the amount of fishing effort that they could engage in. And I'm not sure if they specifically refer to if you're paying a fee on landed weight, you're going to reduce the amount you land, or entirely how they laid that out. And a few sectors, and I thought this was really interesting, they highlighted successful market timing. You know, freed of days at sea and trip limits, they could try to land fish when the price was best. One other thing that I thought was an interesting detail I saw in a couple of the reports was that in addition to the actual operational costs, you know, money of operating the sector, a few pointed out that there was the cost of switching over from a day at sea system to an ace-based system, and that for some members that was the bigger cost, that they had invested in one system and maybe had to now buy into a second system. Next slide, please. So the fishing effort section was really a lot of qualitative information where we sort of opened it up to the sectors to say what worked, what didn't work, why, what they were doing, what they were trying to change. And one of the key things that they raised were about effort controls, or controls that they consider effort, and that's open to a debate at yet another panel. But there were a few things they said was, you know, it's really difficult to manage a portfolio of several stocks with different aces. And that's, on the one hand, we all knew that going in, but I think we always thought about it on the sector level and sector trading to accommodate that, and the sectors really keyed in on how that affected individual members and that that was very difficult for people to try to balance. And that in part, this meant they had to learn to avoid fish, which is a bit counterintuitive for those who have professionally chased fish. And almost to a single sector, they pointed out that both the council and NIMS should really focus on removing, modifying, or reconsidering any remaining effort controls to give them even more flexibility to try to deal with costs associated with sectors, the difficulties of managing a portfolio of ACE, and reduced allocations. And on the plus side, a couple of sectors did highlight that they had a lot of success managing their discards once they, you know, started working on it and targeting it and thinking it through, that they were able to solve that problem in large part. Next slide, please. Okay, so, and you probably have noticed this is basically following the sections of the report because it seemed like a nice logical way to combine the sectors for you. So we also required that the sectors explain the discard estimation method in the report. For this, we basically wrote a generic description and then also provided the formal guidance on discards to be attached to the reports because we felt it was probably easiest if we just get or just provided a single consistent explanation of the method. So the key points, because the discard estimation method was something that I suppose a lot of people who weren't in a sector or at NIMS didn't get a lot of. If your trip actually had an observer or an at-sea monitor on board, the discards that they observed were deducted from the sector's ACES discards. If you didn't have an observer or a monitor on board, we calculated discards based on the trips that were observed. And so to do that, we did a number of things. One, we basically created strata, which just means groups. And for the discard, the strata was a unique combination of the sector, the gear, and the stock they were fishing for. So a given sector, let's say sector one, would have a specific discard rate for fishing for Gulf of Maine cod using 6.5-inch trawl gear. And that would be distinct from sector two using the same gear and the same stock. And to start the year, we based all of our initial rates on previous year's information, and then as we gathered new information through observers and monitors during the year, we transitioned to what we just called an in-season rate, which just meant that the rates for unobserved trips were based entirely on observed trips in that year. And one of the probably the biggest issues about our rate, or the discard ratios as they were developed, is that it's a cumulative system. And what that means is that instead of saying in week one, here's your discard ratio, and in week two, here's a new one, when we updated it in week two, we applied that new rate back to the week one as well as week two. And that happened every week as we went through the year. So on the one hand, this did mean that in the last week of the year, you were recalculating discards for all of the weeks of the year, which on the one hand, you'd say, this is really difficult. How do we plan for this if they could change? But as your year goes on, you have more and more observations, which means that, one, it gets more precise, and two, each individual observation has a smaller change on the overall. So by the end of the year, the changes were much more modest compared to at the start of the year when you only had five or six trips and you added in one more trip, it could change it a lot more dramatically. And the key thing there, as we went through the peer review and developed the discard estimation process, was this provided the most precise estimate of all the methods we looked at. And so when we weighed the pluses and minuses, we said it will be difficult to deal with this cumulative rate as you go through the year, but if it's more precise, that's better for everybody because it minimizes the amount of fish that could erroneously be lost. So as I said, we did provide a sort of a fixed boilerplate piece on this to go in the year-end reports. Some sectors did provide some commentary on it. Primarily, that really got to some of the data issues in terms of the data that went into the discard process and less about the actual method itself. And I think we're ready to go on to the next slide about discards. Okay, so things they did raise. Some people really felt that it was overly complex, in part because every week you had to recalculate all previous weeks. Probably one of the biggest issues raised by some sectors, particularly smaller sectors, was discard impacts for trips that targeted something other than groundfish. And I don't want to go too far into this, but just to give an understanding of what the issue was. For a lot of things, if you're targeting, say, skates, you actually do that on a groundfish trip. And you might be targeting skates, and you might even primarily or even exclusively be landing skates, but you're using gear capable of catching groundfish, you're on a groundfish declared trip, and there's actually nothing to stop you from catching groundfish or landing them or even targeting them on the same trip that you would be targeting skates. And that's true for a number of species like dogfish. And where this came to a real head was for some of the people who had small allocations of groundfish, they had figured that they would just focus on these other stocks, maybe even lease out any allocation the sector gave them of groundfish. But what they found was they still had to have some groundfish because when they went on that trip and got skate, there were calculated discards for groundfish on that trip. Now, in some ways, that right off the bat sounds counterintuitive. Well, if he's fishing for skate, why are you assuming it's a groundfish trip? And in part, that's because there's no way in the current system to distinguish that trip. You make a groundfish declaration, you use groundfish gear in a groundfish area, and you can take groundfish. The fact that you targeted skates and maybe got a lot more of them isn't something that can be planned for right off the bat. And so since you're still on a groundfish trip, you end up with discards. And where this comes to a head is that if two people in the same sector are using the same gear in the same area, say the Gulf of Maine, one of them's targeting skates and he probably really has a clean fishery, the other one is targeting groundfish and has a higher amount of discards. They're put together. And so while on one hand you'd say, so you're artificially increasing the discards of the skate trip, well, you're also artificially lowering the discards of the trip that truly targeted groundfish. When you roll them back up, and when we look at the sector level where we're monitoring ACE, it's probably, well, according to the peer review, it's a precise enough way to do it. But when the sectors decide to sub-allocate and really manage at that level functionally, it created huge problems for them on that individual level. So it's one of the biggest issues in general that we confronted in the year, and particularly here's where it comes up is when we talk about the discard estimation method in the year-end reports. This is what we get back, that people have a major problem with that. And there are a few solutions to that that are, well, some that are in the works, others that are in consideration, and a lot more that I think will come up in some of the later panels. There was a general issue raised just about data quality and how that, data quality, how that impacts discards, but then also the possible impact of observer effect. which observer effect is just sort of the piece of jargon where we say, we're pretty sure that when you have someone watching you do something, you behave in some way differently than when you are not watched. It's a known thing, we accept it, but it's very difficult to quantify. And in this case, for the first year of sectors, we don't have a specific analysis looking at that yet. And some people highlighted that as a real concern, that they're wondering how much of a role that had and how that affected what actually happened during the year. I think one thing I would like to highlight is that we did really, throughout the year, we worked on the process of reporting, not so much changing the discard estimation method, but the process around that of how they calculate it, how they provide data to NIMS, how we provide it back to the sector. That we really did work on through the year. We made a number of changes generally because we were trying to improve the program. And I want to highlight that because I think one of the biggest themes about this, in addition to pluses and minuses throughout the year, is there was an excellent collaboration between the industry and the service as we tried to confront the issues together and solve them together. And actually, the last bullet is probably something I don't want to gloss over. At least one sector raised the idea that they should have finer discard strata to avoid grouping unlike trips. And so when I said we talked about strata and that it was, you know, your sector, a given gear type, and a given stock or stock area for various species, they felt that even though two vessels were using the same gear in the Gulf of Maine from the same sector, if one was fishing really far out in the Gulf of Maine and one was really close inshore, that those were disparate enough, they didn't think it was appropriate to group them together. And this raises another concern about how to handle the discard method as it is now. The more those strata you create, the harder it is to have precision in any one of them. Because let's just say there's 100 trips in the year, as a mathematical simple example. If you've got five strata, then you know, and there's roughly 20 trips in each strata, that can give you a certain amount of precision. But if there's 100 strata, now you've got one trip in each strata, it's really hard to get precision there. And so it's one of the things we did try to balance through the year. We did create effectively a couple of new strata during the year for the haddock separator trawl and the rule trawl because, you know, it was agreed throughout that these were distinct enough from other gears that they shouldn't be grouped with standard otter trawls. But at some point you have to decide how far you go down the road of subdividing each different gear type from all others. When are they different enough that they should be unique, and when are they similar enough that they can be grouped together despite their differences? And I think I'll leave it there for discard estimation. Violation reports. This is a part of the year-end report that really just comes entirely from the sector. During the year, the sectors report to us weekly, and that actually occurs through three separate reports. There's an ACE summary report, which just looks at ACE balances. There's a detail report that goes by trip. And then there's a sector trip issue report, which is where they usually give us our first notice that there was a violation either of the regulations or of aspects of the operations plan that the sector had written and agreed to. And then at the end of the year, we get sort of the detailed summation of that, you know, what happened, how was it investigated, what was determined, what actions were taken, if any. The good news is, in total, the sector's only reported 10 violations in their year-end reports. I think it's a slight understatement, and I don't think it was intentional. In fact, there were very few violations that, you know, came to Office of Law Enforcement, which is, you know, kudos to the industry. But I think there were a number of smaller infractions of operations plans that either were mistakes or misunderstandings, things that were ultimately resolved quite easily. But we didn't really get that information in the year-end reports, and it would have been nice to have that because it was really designed to report on not just violations of the regulations, but infractions that occurred within the operations plan and how that was dealt with. A key example would be, I think we got an undercount of the number of times they had delays with people reporting VTRs on time. But overall, not a lot of violations, and that was a highlight of the year. Next slide, please. So on to catch information. This is one of the parts of the report where NIMS basically provided a table to each sector. The idea was, in the end, catch came down to our final numbers. We might as well just provide it to the sectors, save them the work of recreating the wheel. However, we did encourage the sectors to caveat or put in text if they had any concerns, issues, discrepancies, or just disagreed with some of the information that was there. So we did get some of that. Some sectors just put a couple of footnotes to explain the columns, you know. Others really wanted to raise particular concerns where they disagreed with a point of information from the service. Uh, I suppose a key thing here is gets to how we handle data throughout the year. And the idea was that we would be reconciling data between the sectors and the service throughout the year. And that really didn't happen till late in the fishing year, which was not the plan, but we had problems, we had to solve them, and that's when we were able to do it. And so what it led to was the end of the year, there was a large portion of the catch data that still had to be reconciled between the sectors and the service. Everybody put in a huge amount of effort on both sides, a lot of long hours, a lot of cantankerous meetings to try to solve problems and find missing pieces of data. You know, and the truth is, at the very end of the year, not everybody always agreed on the resolution or what was solved and what wasn't solved, or drawing the line and saying, all right, we still don't know where that missing piece is, but we've got to draw the line, we've got to end the year, we've got to do the final numbers, we've got to move on to next year. Next slide, please. So just a little bit of summary information for all the sectors together. It's one table, it's two slides. I don't have any fancy graphics because I don't really know how to do that. Probably the most interesting thing here is the right column, which is just the percent of the ACE for any given stock that wasn't caught during the year. And you'll see in almost all cases, it's greater than 10%, which is the amount they could roll over into the next year. Next slide. And this is in your handout, so if you're really interested in going over this stuff, you've got it in front of you. I'm not going to make you stare at it here on the table. Next slide, please. And here we get into a little bit more interesting thing, ACE trades and redistribution. So overall, every sector traded out ACE, and all but one sector traded in some amount of ACE. So in that sense, you could say the ACE market was definitely fluid, that everybody was participating. By my count from SIM, 16.4 million pounds was traded between sectors. And then one of the interesting things in this was actually in most of the operations plans for anyone who read that level of minutiae, but also comes up in the year-end reports, is almost every sector implemented some form of basically what is called a right of first refusal, similar to real estate, where someone has an option to take a deal that you've made before someone else does. In the case of sectors, it generally said, if we've allocated some portion of our ACE to you and you want to trade that out to somebody else, in order for it to go from sector to sector, that has to happen at the sector level. And the sector would first allow other members within the sector to take that deal before they traded it out to another sector. And then in some sectors, they actually added the second level of that, which was to say, all right, well, if no one in the sector wants to take it, are there sectors that we work cooperatively with that we want to give a first shot at it before we just send it out to an open market? And this is something that entirely came from the sectors. It's one of those things where you say, all right, it's an operations plan. It's up to the sectors to decide how they want to operate, how they want to do business. And some sectors were really happy with how they did this. Some sectors or members didn't seem so happy with it. But this entirely came down to how the sector chose to operate. But I thought it was a really interesting thing to raise, because it certainly came up, you know, if somebody was upset about it, they were sure to call us, and we were sure to let them know that that was a private business transaction, and that went back to the sector. About the ACE trades and the redistribution, ACE trades have to be approved by NIMS. And the way it's written up is that the trade is submitted to NIMS, and after NIMS notifies both parties, then it's approved and then it takes place. And that in doing that, we also tried to collect a lot of information. We basically, in our online system, allowed you to go right online, propose a trade to somebody else, and if they accepted it, it would automatically approve as long as you're up to date with your reporting requirements. This included a number of things. The ACE trade itself, we asked for information about the value of the trade. However, that we didn't actually start asking for until partway through the year as we developed our systems and tried to make sure we'd caught everything. And that was one of the things we said, weren't we supposed to collect that? And our bad. So we implemented that partway through the year, which is part of the problem with why we don't have a lot of great information about ACE trade value, is that we didn't really start collecting it till later in the year. And then one of the things about ACE trades is when we looked at reporting requirements, you know, our idea was if you're up to date with reporting, then you have sufficient information that you can make good ACE trades because you know what you've got. And in that, we included vessel trip reports, in part because the vessel trip report is how we find out the stock where the catch was made. And so we can take the dealer information, and then when we have a vessel trip report, we can attribute that to a stock, particularly important for things like cod. You get more than one stock, you've got to know which one it is. This caused a lot of problems. One, VTR compliance, maybe not so hot. And there's a detail to that. VTR has a number of required fields. It's a pretty thickly filled page of boxes and tick boxes to provide information to NIMS. If you missed any of the required fields, we send it back to you. And we consider it not received because we don't have a completed form. That would mean your sector can't trade ACE if we enforce it like that. This was a huge problem for people. So we looked at a few different ways to do this. We tried delaying the implementation to make sure we had time to try to sort through the systems. We tried to better explain to people what the problems were, why their reports were getting sent back. Issues were raised about, well, how would the sector know that it was sent in but you rejected it? So this is one of the many things where we had a lot of trouble throughout the year, and one of the things where we worked a lot to solve, and now we've actually built a system where we track the ones that come in, we track when they were sent back and why, and that information is available to the sector manager now, and the intent is, well, it's a little less than 60 days now because it's been up for a bit, but that will re-implement the idea of you have to have all your VTRs in to be reporting compliant to conduct your ACE trades. So summary for ACE trade information. We know precisely how much ACE was traded between sectors. We have limited information on the economics of those trades, in part because we started collecting the information late, and we have much more limited information about individuals. Where the sector divided up that ACE to its members, if it was going out to another sector, they were probably attributing incoming ACE or outgoing ACE to a particular member. We didn't really have that information. We did request it very late in the game for the year-end reports. Got a pretty mixed response to that, and that'll go back to questions about confidentiality and availability of information. But it was a real issue, so I wanted to bring it up as one of the things that was also in the year-end reports. Next slide, please. Just a little summary data, and again, this is in your packets, so you don't have to try to read it up here. But it's just a sort of a look, and I just did this by stock, and I did it in hierarchy of how many trades involved that stock. Most trades involved multiple stocks. So you can't just sum up the number of trades here to get an accurate count. But you can see Gulf of Maine Cod by far was involved in the most actual trades. And it was pretty high up there in terms of actual number of pounds that were traded. And I just thought it was interesting to put it up, you know, when looking at all the sectors trading back and forth to see what was moving most frequently and what was moving in the largest volume. Next slide, please. The awkwardly named other relevant information. If we go back to Amendment 16 and the implementing regulations, it talks about requirements for year-end reports. It gives several very specific things and then has a very powerful and vague phrase, then other information necessary to evaluate biological, economic, and social impacts of sectors. This is one of those things where the council builds in some latitude and leaves it to the agency to decide how best to implement that. And that's where we come up with things like guidance documents and the year-end report guidance, which I will admit came out after the end of the fishing year. It was asked for throughout the year. You know, the sectors kept saying they wanted the guidance. We worked on it. It was actually a lot of work to put that together because, like many things in the sector world, it wasn't so simple as just, well, I'll rewrite the brief regulatory section in plain English and hand it out to people. We had to interpret phrases like that, and we had to figure out, now that we've built an actual system of reporting that goes back and forth between the sectors, how does that actually affect the data that goes into the reports? And so I think it was May 24th that we put out the formal guidance on the year-end reports. And this is one of the most contentious portions. Because in looking at this, we said, all right, well, if we really want to look at economic, social, biological impacts, we need a lot of information. Specific business information, prices, who's involved in a trade. And that's where we went back and forth a lot over the summer with the sectors trying to get information. Some sectors had it and were able to provide it. Some just opposed it in general. They felt it wasn't information they should be providing. Others said, you know, you never asked me to collect it. I didn't collect it. I can't get it now. So we had a range of response to that, and part of it was a timing issue, and part of it was people have very mixed emotions about this level of information. Next slide, please. Actually, you know what? Let's go back to that one because I skipped some stuff that I should have brought in. So not surprisingly, some people liked sectors and some people really did not. an interesting point in some of the year-end reports was that a lot of people, because it was such a big change, approached it cautiously at the start of the year. And in some cases, they said they felt that led in part to some of the under-harvest we saw. Because early in the year, particularly with some of the stocks that had very limited allocations, they really weren't sure how they wanted to fish them, how they wanted to trade them, how they could avoid them or not. And as people experimented, found that they could do things better, fishing improved. But, you know, I think it's a key thing to leave in there. It's like people were cautious, which is pretty smart. But in some ways, you know, that meant that this first year, not surprisingly, may not be representative of next year's and had some issues. Amongst the economic information we did get, pretty much every sector charged a per pound landing fee as a way to raise revenue for sector operations. Some also had a membership fee that was sort of a flat fee that covered some of the operations fees. And nearly every report highlighted the cost of ACE trading, not just as a cost, but as a new cost, that, you know, this was a definitive new thing that was taking money away. And, you know, there's a lot that can go into that discussion, and I'm going to leave it there for the report. Okay, now I'm ready for that next slide. An interesting point some people raised in their reports was that the amount of time necessary to operate a sector was really burdensome. And by this, they didn't just mean the initial startup, but the idea of having sector meetings and having to deal with the manager or deal with other members. And it was not only a burden, but in some cases, they said it took away from the amount of effort they could spend fishing, because you have a finite amount of time in your life that you can spend on this business, and the stuff you spend shoreside is generally taken away from your time oceanside. Monitoring costs, not surprising, were a huge overall concern. Every sector highlighted concerns about paying for at-sea monitoring in 2012. We now know that NIMS is going to be able to fund that for 2012, so for 2012 that issue disappears, and I'm sure they're going to want to continue to talk about that issue for future years in one of the later panels. Next slide, please. Data management was something that came up all over the place in year-end reports. It came up in how reporting occurred. It came up in the tables we provided them with information. It came up in discussions of the discard method. I think there's a few, well, I've broken it down here into just a few issues that I think cover almost all of the issues. Timeliness of reporting by vessels and dealers. If you don't have the information now, you don't have it. Having it next week, well, that's great next week, but today, that gets you nowhere. And there's a lot of data that doesn't come in the timely way that you would think. And we've worked a lot on that. Office of Law Enforcement has done a huge amount of outreach and education trying to improve people's ability to comply with getting data in timely. But then it's also how data is handled in a timely way. And then along with that is completeness and accuracy. One example, as I said, was people might submit their VTR, but if it's not filled out all the way, it goes back. So that creates a problem. And this can be true of everything from dealer reports, vessel trip reports. And some raise concerns about how we process the data. Again, the example of VTRs, some people felt that, well, you can't just send it back because it's incomplete. You know, take the information you got and then worry about the rest later. So issues were raised. Some of it we've tried to address, particularly with the VTR and how we handle sendbacks. Some of it's still out there that we're still working on collaboratively, best ways to deal with processing data. And that's everything from timeliness to how we deal with things that are incomplete. And along with that is the data reconciliation process and how we handled corrections to data when we did have that reconciliation. Biggest concern there, of course, was the timeliness in terms of when it started, how much data there was to work on, and the little amount of time left. For this year, we've already started reconciliation, so we're months and months ahead of year one already. My hope is that continues and that we are nowhere near in the situation we were at the end of the first year. We're coming towards the end of the year. We've already reconciled most of the data and only have, you know, marginal amounts except for the new data coming in to worry about. And here's a key one, and this goes back to all the discussions and development of Amendment 16, how we operate in terms of managing all fisheries, and that is, you know, the default assumption is that NIMS's data is correct. And that comes down to, okay, what if it's wrong? Well, if it's wrong, we will change it if we now know what the new correct data is. And that comes back to us as the agency to make that determination. Not everybody agrees with that default assumption, particularly when it comes to sectors where managers are getting a lot of real-time information. They feel, well, maybe you didn't get that piece of information, but I have it. So why am I using your information? And so a lot of sectors highlighted that as one of their concerns in the year-end reports. And I guess the summation of that is monitoring and data issues basically took the majority of resources, whether it was computing time, money, human hours, in terms of the first year. Most of the back and forth, most of the hard problem solving really came down to data, calculations, transmission of information. But this is where I was saying before that I was really happy about the collaboration, is that that happened. There was a lot of back and forth. That is cantankerous. That is really hard day in and day out to have people at each other, but that, in fact, is how we solve problems, and some we solved, some we're working on, some are still looming large, but that's the nature of a new program. Next slide, please. This, I don't have a lot to say, but I wanted to point out two things. One was the Gloucester Fishing Community Preservation Fund. I think everybody knows it's a private permit bank. It's designed to help the Gloucester fleet. Majority of their permits were entered into a sector this year and used to lease out ACE to sectors for vessels to use. And I just wanted to raise it because it's kind of a neat thing about sectors is the way this interacted. The second thing I raised is the Northeast Sector Support Network, which is NESN with two S's. And this basically for the 12 Northeast fishery sectors was something that was designed for them. And I just wanted to highlight it because I think it's neat because I think it's the first sector-specific organization. So in the first year, we've already actually seen sectors and industry look and say, all right, well, we're going to have all these sectors. This is the new mode. We should have like a sector-specific organization that works on these issues. So I just wanted to raise that as an interesting thing that developed in the first year. Next slide, please. So sort of to sum up the year-end reports, it's lots of information about landings, discards, amount of ACE traded, varying levels of details if you look at the individual reports. And then we come back to really the key question, and this is really a tricky one on a number of levels. Do the year-end reports meet the expectations or the needs of the council? On the one hand, the council staff have seen them. The council members have not. So that leads us to the situation where we can do summaries like this. Analyses can be done using the data in ways that use it but protect the confidentiality of parts that aren't otherwise public. And in the end, it'll be up to the council to decide, did you get what you needed? You know, or, you know, as you hear the panels discuss individual aspects of the year, when they talk about responsibilities of managers, when they talk about how we interpreted what those other relevant information pieces were, it comes back to you guys. What is it you're really looking for? Do we need to change that? Do we need to just tighten some stuff up? You know, that's yours. Next slide, please. Okay, so that was to sum up the year-end reports. And just a little thing I wanted to tack on the end is to talk a little bit about how we made it work this year. Really the key goal of the workshop is to talk about what we still need to fix, because that's, you know, how you productively move forward, less so sitting around giving each other accolades. But I wanted people to understand that we didn't wait, you know, neither industry nor the agency waited till the end of the year to say, so did anything go wrong? All year, this is pretty much what we did with our time. Next slide, please. So just a few points about how the year went. Outreach was huge. Obviously, one of the roles of government, if you run anything, if you regulate, you've got to do outreach. And we really tried to turn it up because this was something new. It was something big. It was new to us and the industry. Lots of workshops, training meetings. We started out with weekly conference calls with all the sector managers as the year started, just so we could check in and say, okay, how's it going? What's wrong? What's good? As the year went by and problems decreased, numerically anyway, we moved that to biweekly. At the end of the year, it was really down to monthly. But it's a great thing to be able to just check in on a fixed basis and be like, oh, you know what, I'm going to add this to my list of things to bring up the next time we talk. And it can be better than one-on-ones, especially if you've also got one-on-ones separately, because sometimes you want to bring something up and like, oh, four other sectors have the same issue. Well, that's more interesting. Maybe there's something different or some aspect of it that we need to consider in how we find that solution. And as I said, there were lots of individual meetings with managers. You know, Eric Schwab met with every manager. Not just us. It was, you know, we really wanted to talk with everybody. We did a lot of written outreach materials, and we've gotten a lot of feedback on those. So thank you for that, which was constructive. We'll try to make them better as we go forward. We had our own end-of-the-year workshop in August to try to check in about, you know, as we move into the second year, what can we work on outside of the council process, things that really came down to policy and operations on our level. Next slide, please. As I said, we did have a lot of written guidance. We provided guidance on the operations plans, how to write those, what they need to be in there, guidance on the weekly reports that get submitted to NIMS, how the SIM online system that we built for sectors worked, how to report incidents, year-end report guidance, and you know, sometimes we were late, sometimes we needed to add more stuff in there, but all of this was this collaborative all through the year, like, oh, you need more information from me on how to do that? All right, we'll sit down, we'll try to get you some more information, help you get there. There was a lot of assistance. You know, in the end, we ended up preparing the NEPA documents, which I think was really probably a great thing for all the sectors to not have to worry about writing their own NEPA documents. As we moved forward with things like exemptions, we were able to expand any exemption to every sector, which got a little bit away from I wish I'd thought of that. Now I got to wait a whole year to put it in my operations plan next year. Next slide, please. You know, and a lot of it was IT, for which I take no credit, other than raising problems to people and asking them, can you find a technological solution to this? SIM just stands for Sector Information Management Module, and this is basically the portal that sector managers use to come in and get information from NIMS, provide information to NIMS, lets them download all sorts of things like dealer data, observer data. The pre-chip notification system, while not new and not specific to sectors, made lots of changes so that it could accommodate the sector system as well as the existing day at sea system. JIRA, which honestly doesn't stand for anything, it's just a name, is basically an online problem tracking software, and it's a way for specifically things like data for sector managers to put in an issue and see it, how it progresses. As NIMS receives it, tracks it, both sides can see progress made, resolutions found. As I said, we built a way to track the sending back of VTRs, so we're trying to use that as a solution to another problem. And for the public, we put up a website with all the ACEs, and we put up lots and lots of information just on the public web that said, interested in sectors, here it all is. And in fact, we're trying to revamp it now to make it even more user-friendly. And of course, there was that ACE monitoring and reconciliation, the bane of everyone's existence, but you know what, it's fixing problems, which is a lot better than just saying, yeah, sorry. And it's gone going. So there's all this stuff that's going on all the time. Next slide, please. So to really finally have a conclusion, because you've had enough. Communication, not surprisingly, is probably one of the biggest things that went on. Yes, it's about phishing, but any time that information is involved or things change, communication is how you make that all work. Collaboration was huge this year, and my thanks to the industry for putting up with it. Sometimes it's easier just to say, you don't know what you're doing, the system doesn't work, I'm out of here. Coming back day after day and not just reminding us that I haven't solved something, but bringing solutions, bringing proposals, keep it coming. That, I think, is one of the best things about sectors, is that we haven't solved everything yet, but we have a way to do it. And flexibility. All the exemptions, everything built into the sector system by the council, provided a whole range of flexibility to sectors. And you know what? They're going to want to talk to you about that, what worked, what didn't work, what else they're interested in. But flexibility also meant how industry dealt with the service and how we dealt with them. We were both pretty flexible about being honest that, yeah, it's year one, and we don't have everything worked out. We're going to try to solve it together, and sometimes things are going to take longer here or less time there. And everybody on both sides was flexible, and I appreciated that. And along with that came the patience and follow through. You know, we are trying to follow through on everything that's been tasked with us, and industry has been generally really good about coming back to us when we ask for something from them. And with there, I'm going to end it and take any questions. I guess we could do something really quick and get out to everybody that just sort of summed up how much money and where it went, you know. I think that would probably be pretty easy to do because it was generally evenly distributed. But as to what additional costs they have, you know, I'm going to defer to them in their year-end reports if they have real costs. I don't know if there's anything you could do to help us with that. It's mostly a data thing. But it'll be really hard even in year two for us to make 60 days when we factor in, well, from a calendar standpoint, last year was actually the best scenario for us where the fishing year actually ended on a Saturday. This year it ends on a Monday or a Tuesday. I'd have to go back to the calendar. But what it'll mean is that the fishing year ends, so let's just say it's Monday. The following Monday, the sectors will send us their weekly report. And then that Tuesday, the dealers will send us their report. So then we'll have to have another week where the sectors do another round of their reports using that final set of dealer data. So there's 2 weeks from the end of the year. Figure a couple weeks after that last submission of data from the sector to NIMS to reconcile the last trips. So now we're 4 weeks out. And then after we've got final numbers, 2 weeks for the sectors to balance any overages with ACE trading, it just doesn't fit in 60 days, as far as I can tell.
More questions?
To weigh the costs and benefits of the residual input controls. Two of them particularly identify one of the closed areas, the main closed areas, and the other is the minimum fish size. There's pros and cons in each of these, but I really think that to get the maximum value out of the sector, particularly some of the inshore small boat sectors, that these need to be looked at. We need to have a forum where we can discuss these amongst ourselves. So, quick question is, will that forum be available? Thank you.
I guess there's a couple of to that. In general, as an agency, we're going to be very supportive of the council wanting to look at or reconsider any of those effort controls. And obviously that includes things like analyses. So if the council's interested in them, they're looking at things, they're looking at specific alternatives, we'll be supporting them and doing analysis. And that may also include cost-benefit, depending on exactly what's being looked at. In terms of a forum, if you mean for industry to meet separately and without us first, I don't know that we've planned anything like that, but if it's something industry wants and wants us to get involved in structuring for them, let's talk about it. Mental note to self to stop using phrase like not so hot in public. I don't know that anybody ever specifically put in the year-end report accuracy of stock attribution, but it was a key part of the things they raised was about what we call data imputation, which was, if we don't have every data piece necessary for every trip, what do you do then? How do you determine, you know, or how do you come up with a number for the missing pieces? And a lot of sectors had a lot of concerns about that. And as the year went on, we actually, well, first we had to build a system that could do this, which was to say, all right, well, I have a dealer report, but I don't have a matching VTR. Or I have a VTR, but I don't have a dealer report. Or I have a VMS declaration that he made a trip, but I don't have either a VTR or a dealer report. What do you do? And so we actually have a really complex but pretty cool system of where we try to take pieces and say, all right, this trip is missing this. Let's look at similar trips, if possible, by that vessel and see if we can, you know, based on that, fill in the gap. Or if we didn't have that earlier in the year, we might look at it at a sector level, at a wider level like that. And one of the things we did get several requests for in the year-end reports was, could we give them a specific breakdown of exactly what trips had that and how they were imputed and what was imputed? And so part of the reconciliation that does go on is saying, all right, here are pieces of information that are missing. Here's what we're filling in the blank with. And so that's happening, and I think they're just looking for maybe even a little more understanding and clarity on how we filled in the blank, not just what it's filled in with and which trips have blanks filled in.
Thank you. Is your office going to be confident that when you provide the council an assessment of the situation, that is the degree to which you have been able to accurately account for George's bank catch versus Gulf of Maine catcher flatfish, that you'll have a high degree of confidence?
We do have a lot of confidence in what we came up with in the end. And, you know, like anything, anytime you filled in a blank, there's a chance it's not exactly accurate. But we're really confident in what we've done.
Okay, so you're doing a lot of cross-checking to the extent that you can verify the catch location so that the ace can be properly I only ask this question because I hear rumors, and of course rumors about government codfish being reported as Georgia's bank codfish, and I hope that, especially in the context of the Gulf of Maine cod assessment, that we'll be getting an update on fairly soon. I hope that the real work, your monitoring, will be enlightening so that we don't find ourselves asking this question at that time. Well, was it really government cod, or was it Georgia's bank cod, or vice versa?
All right, let's take two more questions before we move on. This one in the front.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for the report. It's pretty interesting. I had a couple things I wanted to pick up on. You stated that, at least I think you stated, you were. The service was somewhat surprised that people fished the way they fished. They fished like ITQs instead of assigning boats to fish in certain areas and whatnot. In light of that, do you think there's any changes that we as a council need to make to make this run more like an ITQ system?
I'm not going to touch that with a 10-foot pole. I mean, well, all right, here's the thing. The idea of sectors was to let them have the flexibility to see how they did it. I was surprised in that almost everyone followed the same model. I thought we might see a couple of different things tried, particularly with something new. But, you know, if the council wants to set up an ITQ, you know, you're going to need an amendment, you're going to need a referendum, and we'll support you whichever way you guys are going. But in terms of specific things to facilitate sectors running as an ITQ.
We'll get down an 8-foot pole. Why can we not do discharge by vessel? If I want to use 7-inch mesh, why am I lumped in with all my sector using 6.5-inch mesh? I don't understand why we can't do discharge by vessel instead of a sector.
Several levels to that. One is that we're tracking the ace at the sector level, not at the vessel level. And two is then we get back down to when I talked about earlier about narrowing your strata. You know, we'd get down to every vessel. And so, you know, what if you use a couple of different meshes during the year? We're now going to get enough observed trips with each of the meshes you use in each of the areas you fish to get any kind of a reliable estimate. Generally, those would be the concerns. For more details on that, I would turn to our statisticians.
Okay. My last one, this issue with the BTIs, I'm probably one of the people that drives me insane. Things like, I don't know when I get in until I get in. So I can't write down the time when I get in, but when I get in, I get swarmed by all these people that want to inspect my boat, my catch, my everything else. So a lot of times I forget to fill in the time I get in, and then I get it back a month later in the mail. I would suggest two things. One is phone and call me and ask me what time I'm in, rather than mailing it back. It'd be a lot simpler. And the second is that the sector managers be allowed to submit reports. They get the state card of my report. And you know, if there are people that haven't sent one in, you could at least use that as preliminary information. Sector managers are, I'm going to say they're like our mothers now. You know, wash your hands, brush your teeth, send in your BTR. Whatever it is, but my understanding is that the sector manager can't submit a BTR on behalf of a boat. And
there's a couple levels to that. What we've been trying to avoid is getting two copies of BTRs from two different people, and then resolving that. Certainly, let's say you're an owner with a hired captain. If you choose to have him give it to you and mail it in, if you choose to give it to your manager and then have him mail it in, that's fine. And you could even build into your sector contract some sort of limited power of attorney that says he has that responsibility to send it to us. One of our biggest concerns, though, is that if you sent it in, we sent it back to you, so he sends me his copy with something added, and then I get your corrected copy, and they don't match. We've created a new problem. But we're actually, we're definitely willing to talk about solutions to that, particularly the idea of maybe setting it up where, for a particular sector, that manager handles all the VTRs for their members. You know, we could probably do it at that level, sector by sector, but not vessel by vessel from our standpoint. But one of the things there, why I say sector by sector, is your sector manager, you've got a motherly relationship with. There are definitely some sectors where they don't want their manager in that role, where, they want him to do certain administrative tasks that deal with sending me data electronically, and they don't want their manager to be responsible for chasing them down every day, getting paper copies and mailing stuff for them. So to that extent, we're willing to, work with people on that and maybe do it, do it sector by sector, so long as we have a defined protocol so we avoid things like doubles and triplicates of stuff.
Okay, one more question, if it's a quick one, if someone's got one. Chris, there's one. Chris, back there.
The very back in the pink.
Behind you, yeah.
So, I'm just wondering if there's been any communication from the agency about doing some type of a pilot project, or at least a discussion about some electronic viewer data, real time on the dock, so that essentially all of this information is streamlined to multiple sources at the same time. So the fisherman comes in, they sign off with some type of an electronic ID to the dealer data, who has some type of a handheld recording device. They press send, the data goes to you, it goes to me, it goes to their own accounting programs, so that there's no discrepancies at all, and we get real-time dealer data on the dock. It seems like that's a big issue as far as our sector was concerned, and I think it's a lot of sectors' problems too, is getting dealer data that's now 8 days lag between when we get their VTRs and when they're actually required to report. And so we're dealing then with submitting reports or actually keeping track of ACE on a daily basis based on VTR estimates that are inaccurate, really, which then seems the whole focus has been towards VTRs. Go to electronic VTRs, well, that'd be great. Well, why is that great? Why don't we go towards electronic dealer data and hold dealers more accountable for reporting on a real-time basis, and in a perfect world, which would be awesome, is if you could combine VTRs with a dealer report so that you get one report and you don't have to violate the Paperwork Reduction Act and have all of this unnecessary VTRs that really are redundant and like I said, are out of date by the time we get to use them.
We've definitely talked about the idea with you guys, amongst ourselves, at work, over beers. There are definitely some aspects to that that we would all love to see. There are a few things. We're certainly not at the level yet where we're planning a pilot or funding one or spec one out. One of the issues is we don't entirely control the data set up for dealers because the Atlantic States Marine Fishery Commission is also involved, SAFIS. And so we've got to get everybody on board when we do something like that. I mean, I guess we could do a pilot of our own, but in terms of making sure that all the necessary dealer data goes to all the necessary partners, we have to have more people involved than just NIMS, which is a key thing. And I don't think that should be a roadblock. I think it's just a big first step that would have to be involved in it.
Yeah, I mean, I think...
It's definitely something worth keeping on the table, talking through. You got to remember, too, that if you make it for the dealer, that means every trip, every day for that dealer, not just to satisfy our needs in the groundfish fishery, but every state fishery he's permitted for, every federal fishery he's permitted for, that he's now building that in his system. So I think it's one of the things that needs a lot of discussion to go there, but I think we're open to the discussion.
Thanks, Mark.
Okay, thanks, Mark. I'm actually giving the next presentation, so I hope no one's sick of hearing me talk yet. And we're about 15 minutes behind schedule, but we had an extra long lunch break because of the presentation that was removed, so... I'll try to keep this short. In any case, it won't go beyond 12, so we should still have plenty of time for lunch. So when we were putting together this workshop,